Then someone came to the Buddha, inquiring, and was sufficiently moved by what he heard. He asked the Buddha for ordination in the Buddhist Sangha, the order. And the Buddha would say then, "Come, bhikkhu." Bhikkhu is sometimes translated as monk, but let us use the original word, bhikkhu. "Come, bhikkhu. Well preached is the doctrine. Tread the brahmacharya, the Brahma path," literally the walking in Brahma, "for the complete ending of all ill." Now this, of course, is a tremendous statement altogether. "For the complete ending of all ill." Now, how is ill presented in Buddhism? In its external form, it's presented as jati. We'll deal with jati a little later. As jati, as old age, as decrepitude, death, being associated with what one or whom one dislikes, not being associated with the people one likes, and so on. This is how ill is presented externally. Dukkha. This is called dukkha, suffering. But there is a profounder meaning to it, and that is that it is far from the infinite. Kha, the infinite. Du, far from. Spoilt, made bad. You see? Dukkha. Which, of course, straight away lands us into the fact that it is because our life here is not the expression of the transcendent, of perfection itself, of nirvana. It is that fact which we have to deal with, essentially. All these other things are secondary things. Old age, death, well, they just come, don't they? And the millions of the world take those things in their stride, willy-nilly, intelligently or not so intelligently. So that is not so much the problem. Even the conflict and the misery we go through in life is not so much the problem. But the problem is that our life here is something limited, constricted, twisted, in confusion, and so forth. And it does not express the perfection of the transcendent. This is the real pain, the real suffering, in the spiritual sense. Now, the word jati, usually translated as birth. Jati means really the beginning of an appearance. And because, as far as we individuals are concerned, the beginning of our appearance in this world is our birth, as we commonly call it. Jati means birth. Jati also has its connotations, its secondary meanings, which are, in this particular context, I feel, rather more important. The moment there is an appearance, a finite, limited, particular existence as such, it is conditioned. It is an expression of something which is conditioned, something which is imprisoned. And jati really means the conditioned state, whatever that conditioned state may be. If you look at the Vishuddhi Magga, the path of purity, which was written by Buddha Ghosha, an enormous tome, runs into nearly 1,000 pages of print, and Buddha Ghosha produced 30 such tomes in his lifetime. If you look at the Vishuddhi Magga, you will find Buddha Ghosha clearly saying that when there is an appearance, or let me put it this way, when an appearance begins, people say this is the birth of an entity. There is no such thing, he says. It is the beginning of an appearance. There is no entity involved in it. When that appearance, which is the living body, goes through death, people say that a person has died, goes somewhere, and reappears again. And Buddha Ghosha says that these are incorrect ways of looking at it. To look at it properly, correctly, there is an appearance and there is a disappearance. Of what? An appearance and disappearance of conditioned factors. That is all. There is no entity involved in it. See, this is jati, the meaning of jati. Now, as long as there is a jati, an appearance, living through time and space, having its particular sensations, its thoughts, its ideas, its discriminative consciousness, all of which are restricted and conditioned, there is the state of dukkha, the far from the transcendent. And we, in our lives here, whilst we are alive, we experience this as confusion, as conflict, as pain, as sorrow, also as pleasure, uplift, exalted moods, and all the rest of it. The whole realm of ambivalence we go through. And we are just tossed about this way and that way. And this is the great ill for which the Buddha pointed out that its cause is craving, and the destruction of craving was the way to realize nirvana. Now, who realizes nirvana? No one realizes nirvana. The nirvanic state is present as and when there is the destruction of craving. Now, if the non-nirvanic state, in which, as I commonly say, I am, is got rid of through purification, through understanding, through insight, through wisdom, and through living the holy life, as it is simply called, if that is done, then the nirvanic state is manifest through this living person. But it is not I, the living person, who realize nirvana. In the process by which that realization comes about, this isolative self-consciousness which abstracts the I as separate from you completely vanishes. Now this is what the Buddha taught, and it is not exclusive to the Buddha's teaching. You will find it in the teachings of all the great religions in some form or other. Although, as far as the verbal formulation goes, it is most explicit in the Buddhist formulation. The other religions do not formulate it so explicitly. Even the Vedanta talks in a manner which gives the impression that there is the individual Atma, the personal Atma. But that is an impossibility. How can there be an individual infinite? It denies the meaning of infinity. It denies the meaning of transcendence. My bit of infinity, I might as well stake my claim for my bit of space. 100 cubic feet for me, please. I'm such a big fellow. Therefore, I need that much. Well, what's the good of staking such a claim? I can never get hold of it. No one can give it to me. So, to say my Atma is to talk as the person who has not seen the truth talks. And it's the same in the theistic religions. When, for instance, the theistic religions present man as body, an immortal soul, and spirit, the verbal formulation is obviously faulty. The visible body, of course, is the limited and particular thing. But what is the meaning of my soul or my spirit? My bit of infinity? Then infinity has lost its meaning. It has become the measurable. It is my little bit. And it has to be measurable in order that I may claim it and possess it and keep hold of it. If it is infinite, I can't hold it. It is the infinity which holds this, the body, the living body. So you see, in some form or other, the real teaching is there. But in Buddhism, it comes out most explicitly. Now let's go back to this particular point about putting aside objects of sense, the use of the senses, says the Buddha. It's a curious thing to say. How can you put aside the use of the senses? Understand it as the misuse of the senses. What happens? When I see some object which attracts me, I am entranced by the general appearance of that object, whether it be a living person or an inanimate object or whatever it is. I'm entranced by the general appearance. I'm entranced by the particular aspects of it which attract me very much. And what happens in consequence? There is a state of bondage. There is an uprising of desire to possess it, to enjoy it, and so forth. And that, of necessity, comes to an end. And then there is, oh, it's all over feeling. And there is the craving, tomorrow I shall enjoy it again. I'll go to such and such a place and look at that wonderful tree or that wonderful person or whatever it is. So craving grows that way. But if, whilst one is seeing the object, one sees it with wisdom, that is, one realizes, at this moment there is that which I am seeing. But this is impermanent. It is passing away. It is something which must not be grasped, something to which I must not be attached. When one sees that way, one is not misusing one's senses. This doesn't mean that one doesn't enjoy, in the true sense, the actual process of seeing whilst the event is occurring. One enjoys it to the full in this way, that one is wholly sensitive to the fact of it, to the truth of it. You see that bowl of flowers there, for instance. One enjoys it. One is perfectly aware of the whole fact which is there. And in that awareness, there is an enjoyment which is true happiness. If you have true happiness, you will not want to possess it. You will not want to be attached to it. That is the great point. When the experience is over, it's finished. There is a complete ending to it. It is this complete ending which makes for perfection. To die perfectly to that which you're living through is the perfect way of living through the thing. You know, for instance, when Jesus said, "Be perfect even as your Father is in heaven is perfect," do you know what the word he uses? Or rather, what the New Testament uses, because the New Testament was in Greek, he spoke in Aramaic. Telaios, be ye ended, completed, finished, perfected. That is the meaning, telaios, of telaios. That means completely die to the passing process. Do not be attached to it. Attachment binds, and at the same time, the opposite, aversion to the thing also binds. Therefore, be free from attachment and aversion. And if one is free from attachment and aversion, whilst the senses are active and working, then there is no ill state. This is what it means. Consider the other part of it, putting aside all thoughts, feelings, stimuli, perceptions, intentions, preoccupations, and deliberation of the mind concerned with objects, the objects of sense and the senses. Putting aside all that. Now, whilst one is working, whilst one is moving through one's everyday life, unquestionably, there has to be deliberation and so forth with regard to one's everyday work, and one's everyday work is in terms of the objects of perception, the objects of sense, and so forth. You can't avoid that, obviously. What does the Buddha mean then by putting aside all these in connection with the objects of sense? Not whilst you are actually at work, because you have to pay attention to the thing. And if you pay attention to your work in the office or when you're teaching or whatever you're doing, then obviously there has to be deliberation about the objects of sense. But the deliberation, the intentions, the feelings, the memories and anticipations in relation to the objects of sense, our fantasies, in other words, is what we have to put aside. Watch the fantasies. And watch the way in which any sense object raises up fantasies. This is very important. If I look at my fantasies and really understand them, I will know myself, what I really am. You know, modern psychiatrists and so forth want to analyze your dreams. They want to consider what you dream. Far more useful it is for each one of us not so much to analyze, but to be fully mindful of our fantasies. Practice it, try it, and see the result. At first it might cause considerable upset, horror at facing one's own soul and one's own emotional and intellectual processes. It's a horrifying sight, I know, from experience. It's a frightening sight. It's an upsetting thing altogether. But the person who can face his own soul and quietly go on . He is the true hero. And this is the only living context in which heroism has no element of evil in it. You look at every other act of heroism. There is conflict involved in it, there is perhaps destruction involved in it. There are terrible things involved in all that. Or there is the assertion of ego, which may appear to us to be determination and all the rest of it. But determination directed that way means that I, the separate individual, triumph. And triumph means triumph over, triumph against something else. Where is the harmony of life there? This is the only situation in which heroism has no evil. You face your soul and quietly go on your way with the task of purification. Now, some people would attempt to put aside what we call the evil things or whatever one is taught to put aside by an act of will. But an act of will is a conflict. It doesn't bring a resolution of the difficulty and the problem. It is no true solution at all. One may say that, oh well, I practiced looking at the desire, the thought, the feeling which rose up. And as I looked, that particular urge just vanished away, was reduced to nothingness. But, he says, it comes up again a little later. Now, this is just what happens in most cases. The question then is, how did we look at this? Did we just keep looking at it like we might look at a naughty little boy trying to climb over your gate and he catches your eye and just disappears? Then he comes again, of course, when you are hoping that you are not looking this time, and attempts to climb over your gate. It's that sort of situation. But when we look within ourselves, and we look with sufficient intensity, and continuity, not letting go of the thing, something else happens. Not only does that psychical energy which rose up and produced a disturbance subside, but one begins to understand the process, the life process of that psychical energy. What did it originate from? Not merely just the superficial cause, this stimulus or that stimulus or whatever it was, but you go much deeper and deeper and see its origins. And seeing its origins thoroughly, you will also see what it leads to. And this seeing is far more than an intellectual seeing, far more than an analytical process. This is the important point. Understanding grows this way. And when one has really understood the thing, it ceases to trouble you. Merely seeing it externally, superficially, does not solve the problem. One has to have this inward understanding in the depths, and then that's the end of that problem and any problem similar to it. Recall our school days, and a very good example here is when we studied geometry, say. Well, we learnt the theorem, and most of us just learnt it by heart, parrot-like. And in the exam, of course, we got full marks for just producing all the words. There was the premise, there were the logical steps, there was the conclusion, QED, quite easily done. You see? All right, that was the end of that. Then we went on to the next part of the question. The problem which was set based upon this theorem. Now, instead of dashing off the whole thing exactly according to the book in 2 minutes, now we started scratching our heads and saying, oh my goodness, how do I do this? Can't see it, can't understand this, this is difficult, I can't solve it. Oh, I've got only 5 minutes left. And we chewed off our pens or pencils and all the rest of it, you know, the whole rigmarole which we went through. Now why is that? Why is it that I went through all this and John Brown was able to solve the problem quite easily? What was the difference between him and me in this situation? He had fully understood the theorem. I only knew it superficially. I could, because of a good pictorial memory, I could reproduce the words in the book and so forth. And therefore, I reproduced the theorem correctly and I simply couldn't solve the problem. I did not know how to apply that theorem to the problem concerned. Because I did not understand, really understand the theorem. Now, if I take the trouble to fully understand that theorem, the premises, exactly what they mean, the logical steps, one after the other, exactly what they mean, and therefore, of course, finally, obviously, the conclusion, and understood the real meaning of that conclusion, then I have really understood that theorem and I don't find any difficulty in applying it to problems based upon that theorem. Now it is the same with our inner life. Here the analogy, I think, applies very well. We have something uprising within us, something which causes trouble, conflict, difficulty, and so forth. And we don't look at it in the right way. We don't understand it properly. We must look at it completely and wholly, holding our criteria, evaluations, standards, judgments in abeyance. Just look and keep looking with a mind that is empty of all conditioning factors, as far as we can possibly do so. And then there will be real understanding of what is happening. When that power of understanding comes to fruition, panya, prajna, you see, when that comes to fruition, then that it's not merely that problem as a particular problem which is solved, but everything similar to it is solved forever. Because when there is real understanding, one is completely free of all grasping. One is free of all attachment. One is free of all conditioning in connection with that particular psychological state. But this is very hard work. It's extremely arduous. There are no shortcuts to this. At first, we can't do anything about it. Everything seems a mess. Gradually, we begin to have a little light on the matter. We begin to understand certain things. But if we try to put that understanding into the mold of particular intellectual conclusions, then these will obstruct us next time the thing arises. Don't come to conclusions about it. No judgments. No condemnations. Just remain awake and watchful, awake and watchful. Hasn't it been said in the political sphere that the price of peace is eternal vigilance? Churchill used that phrase. The price of peace is eternal vigilance. Eternal vigilance. This is the meaning of remaining awake, of being awake. There are many factors involved in this. One is, of course, the question of interest. How seriously are we interested in this? Or are we interested in nirvana after the fashion of a man who has, we'll say, a fair amount of money, and he looks in a shop window and is attracted by an object and he can afford it and he goes and buys it and there you are, I've got it. Now you see, he's acquired an object. He possesses an object. And an object by itself is an inanimate thing. He looks at it at times, he gets pleasure. After a time perhaps he may get bored and give it away to somebody or sell it or something like that. But you see, life becomes desultory that way, doesn't it? It's just an aimless meandering. There is no real growing, no coming to fruition that way. If we are really interested in human fulfillment and fruition, then we will keep paying attention. It is a case of the real interest. What do we really care for? True fulfillment or the satisfaction of desires, ambitions, and so forth? All right. Enough for that. Now let us relate it to something, another point. We were talking about words last time and the significance of words. Is it all right for you? You see, words. And you know what words represent. Limited, finite objects. They represent moods. They represent feelings, thoughts. A collection of words makes up ideas, and so forth. But all these things are particular, finite, mortal. They come into being, proceed, and die. Words are confined to the realm of mortality, to the realm of death. This is an important thing to bear in mind. Words are confined to the realm of death. Now, in our everyday life, what is it that obstructs or interferes with, intrudes upon a state of transcendence? A state of complete harmony with the infinite. Objects, the objects of sense. All sense perceptions. Whatsoever is sense perceived, through sight, through hearing, through touch, through taste, and through the discursive thought and speech process, is finite and limited. Now, if we really see this, we will see why all the religions have admonished us to turn away from the indulgence of the senses. Because if it is the infinite, if it is transcendence, if it is God, which is another way of saying your true fulfillment as a human being, if that is our real concern, then all these things are obstructions. Do we really understand this? I mean, do we really more than just logically see it? Because if a thing is presented to you, if something like this is presented to you, and the intellect follows it logically and is compelled to give assent, your inclination will be against it. The inclination is our animal urge. Our animal urge is against it. That is a fact, isn't it? We must face that fact. So, words, objects, and the senses, they all are mixed up in one complex of the finite, the limited, the particular, the realm of mortality, the realm of conflict, and hence suffering and misery and all the rest of it. Is that quite clear? Because I want to lead on to this very important thing we call meditation. You look at all the teachings with respect to meditation, contemplation, deep prayer, the Unio Mystica, communion, call it what you like. You see? All the religions which have spoken about this, taught this, have pointed out that there is a complete cessation of words and thoughts as one enters or tries to enter into the state of deep prayer, contemplation, communion. There is a cessation of the flow of discursive thought and speech. Words come to an end. Now you take, for example, the Buddhist presentation, which is a very concise and precise presentation, just as the presentation in yoga is also very, very precise, which you will find scattered through the Upanishads. Let us take the Upanishadic presentation. And you see, yoga is not something separate from all this. We talk of Hindu yoga, Buddhist yoga, they're all one thing. Let us take the Upanishadic presentation. It's presented in four aspects, what they call the waking state, Jagrat. Jagrat is the waking state, as we are now here. I hope everybody is awake and not fast asleep. You see? Then the dreaming state, the dreamless slumber state, and then the Turiya, the fourth state, as they call it, which is actually the transcendent state. In the Buddhist presentation of the jhanas, we have, just for convenience of talking about it, first, second, third, fourth jhana, and we also have four samapattis. Samapatti means coalescence, and it's very important to appreciate the meaning of samapatti, a coalescence, in which, in these coalescences, one enters into the state of the infinite akasha, mind space, infinite vijnana, discriminative consciousness, the plane of no thing, as it is called, of neither perception nor non-perception, and finally the complete cessation of all perception and feeling. Now do not think, therefore, that these are, in the Upanishadic presentation, four rungs on a ladder, or in the Buddhistic presentation, eight rungs on the ladder. It is convenient to talk of them as four avasthas, the waking, dreaming, dreamless slumber, and the transcendent, four avasthas, and the four jhanas and four samapattis. It's convenient to talk in terms of numbers, but their actual meaning is just this, that the intensity of your awareness of totality varies. They only represent a variation in the intensity of your awareness of totality. Is that quite clear? Now, as there is a variation in the intensity of awareness, certain factors go into the hinterland of consciousness. Now here the Buddhist presentation is extremely valuable and helpful. We talk of first, second, third, fourth jhana. The first jhana incidentally simply means, it's the Sanskrit dhyana, and it simply means attention. Dhyana, giving attention. See, and this is what is commonly called the process of meditation, of contemplation. In the first stage, there are certain factors present. Applied thought and discursive thought. You choose an object of concentration, an object of attention. You keep your mind on it, but in this case, you are talking about it. It is an analytical, discursive process, trying to see what it is about, what this thing is, trying to discover its nature, its qualities, and so forth. There is rapture associated with it. Piti, the Pali. Rapture. And you will physically experience this rapture in various ways. One of its simplest forms is, you get sort of goose flesh. Hairs on your body begin to stand up. Sense of rapture. And when it gets to its end point, so to say, it can be so powerful, so it is said, that there could be actual physical levitation. I have never witnessed it myself, and I'm not one of those people who swallows things lock, stock and barrel simply because it has been said, but I keep an open mind about it. I have never seen it. That's the rapture part. Then there is sukha, happiness associated with it. Now this sukha, this happiness, must be has no relationship to pleasure in the sense of a pleasurable sensation which ordinarily comes into our life. Pleasurable sensation because we see something lovely or touch something fine or beautiful, it's a wonderful sensation, and so forth, you see, all the sensations. There's no relationship to that. This is happiness, pure and simple. Happiness which has no beginning and no dying. No birth and no death. So you get your first foretaste of what ultimately we call nirvana right from the beginning. It is always there. See, happiness is associated with it. And a state of equanimity. A state of equanimity. Balance. Not the balance which is a seesaw equilibration. But the balance which is a true dynamic poise. You, the living being, are vibrating in a state of harmony. These are the factors present in what we are, in what is described as the first jhana. Now, the next stage, the second jhana, is the term applied to that condition where discursive thought has stopped. Now, have you ever experienced that, actually? Being awake and mindful, but discursive thought has stopped. The flow of words is no longer present. Observe this, practice this. Don't try to stop it, you never will be able to do it that way. It will stop by itself. You just remain mindful and watchful, you remain still, quiet, unmoving in the mind. You see, then that flow of words stops. Now, consider carefully. Words, sense objects, sense experiences belong to the realm of the limited, the finite, the mortal, That has stopped. How are you aware? If mortality has ceased, you are aware in terms of non-mortality, of immortality. More than 20 years ago, I saw this, that this is the real meaning of immortality. It is the nirodha, the stopping of this, that and the other, which the Buddha talks of. It's the stopping of mortality. But in which sense is mortality stopped? In terms of the movement of my awareness. My consciousness doesn't flit from one object which is held in the mind to another object, from one thought to another thought, from one perception, from one memory, from one anticipation to another. There is an extraordinary state of inward stillness. And then you begin to sense for the first time the meaning of thought power, which is not the power of a string of words flowing along. But note carefully, stillness. The mind becomes more and more still, and therefore the discursive thought process comes to its ending. Now you'll see the raison d'etre of the practice in yoga, the body stillness, the utter and perfect stillness of the body. Is a concomitant of the utter and perfect stillness of the mind. If and when the mind and the body can realize complete stillness, and this stillness need not necessarily mean that the body is not moving. This is one of the mysteries. You can be walking and yet be complete, in complete dynamic poise, physically as well as mentally. And then you are in that state where power, this immeasurable, this dimensionless, this transcendent, this divine creative energy, this power functions through that person. You won't find this written anywhere. You will find that it affects an extraordinary sense of release, an extraordinary sense of non-existence, an extraordinary sense of total being. A total being which cannot be separated from, extricated out of, complete awareness, an indescribable awareness. It is this sort of state in which the organism is, which is essential for what is known as the unio mystica. It is the state of the unio mystica. It is a state of transcendent peace, of happiness, of love. For the first time you will know love, which you cannot put into words. You know that all thought, all speech with respect to that love is just a shadow of the reality. Insubstantial, all thought and speech about it. But it is a reality. You will naturally ask, well, what is your evidence that it is a reality? The evidence is just this, the transformation of your own being. When it happens, you will know it has happened. There is at least one type of experience in our ordinary mortal life which is something like that. When two people really experience that magic which is love, about which there is no question, no talk, no excitement even, but one just knows this is it, then you don't need evidence, you don't need proof. You know this is it. It's there. And this is merely the second jhana. In the third, the rapture subsides. When the rapture also subsides, there is an intensification of that inward balance. And then, with the subsiding of the rapture, there is a subsiding of the happiness too. That happiness subsides, and simultaneously with it, the other dual of the ambivalent sphere, sorrow, subsides with it. It subsides. This sorrow is the sorrow which is the clear understanding of the nature and the meaning of being far from the transcendent, far from the infinite. That is a sorrow, personally, that doesn't subside and disappear until this stage. There is still another sorrow, another dukkha, which never goes and never must be allowed to go. The thing which in Christian mysticism has been called the wound of love. And quite rightly, treasure that wound. If that wound ever heals, down you come back again to the sphere of conflicting mortality. That wound of love is the awakened state to the sorrow of the world, the suffering of the world. It's such a sensitivity that the sense of separateness from the world is completely out. It's no case of my sorrow or his or her sorrow. It is the awareness that there is sorrow here. This is the banishment from one's divine home, one's eternal home, the transcendent. It's the awareness of that banishment. And as long as there is manifestation, there is appearance, there is jati, the limited state, the conditioned state, constriction, imprisonment, there isn't freedom. And then in the fourth jhana, there is the complete equanimity only. A state of extraordinary ease. What's happened to words? They have vanished altogether but they are latent within the living person. As long as there is an organism, words are latent there. They have to be. Because whatever the marvelous states you go through, whatever degree of transcendence you realize, the brain traces are not obliterated. Whatsoever we have experienced, thought, felt, etc., makes its trace in the brain. And remember, with 10,000 million brain cells and all the pathways, the innumerable pathways which are there, everything has made its impress. Destroy the brain cells themselves, then of course it would go, but then you are that much less, isn't it? Chop off my right arm and see how much I am diminished thereby in my effectiveness or usefulness. Isn't that so? So that is no way out. That is why suicide is no way out of anything. So the brain traces are not destroyed. So everything is there, but in a state of peace now. It's in a state of peace. And in that state of peace, there is a transformation, actually, of the psychical nature of all those influences, conditions, states, impressions, which left a brain trace. That gets transmuted. That is why the Holy One, the really Holy One, who can enter, and he is the one who can enter these states. It is said of him that all evil-mindedness is burnt out. This you get in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for instance. All evil-mindedness is burnt out. Sarvam papmanam. And because all evil-mindedness, usually translated by the scholars as all evils are burnt out. No, it is not all evils are burnt out. This evil and that evil and that evil. It's the whole thing, lock, stock and barrel. Evil-mindedness itself is completely burnt out. And the Upanishads don't talk to a philologist this way, because he'll say you're talking nonsense, and he'll be quite right, because philology doesn't accept all the Upanishadic statements along these lines. The Upanishads give the hint. The person, Purusha, is the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. The word Purusha, they split up into Purva for the Pu, meaning formally, and the Usha comes from the root Ush, meaning to burn, and then the words Sarvam Papmanam follow, you see. The Purusha is one who has burnt out all evil-mindedness. That's the actual explanation which the Upanishads give, which is, from the standpoint of a scientific philologist, nonsense. Well, let it be nonsense from the standpoint of the philologist. But for us, it is of tremendous value. This is the meaning of person. One in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. Now you see why the theistic theologies have talked in terms of the divine person. God, the divine person, God, the all good, the absolute good. But this is what one realizes in these deep states of consciousness. And the person, that individual himself, is transformed. He is the Holy One. So now, the words are there in their latency, but all evil associated with the words has vanished. See, otherwise, I mean, it's only a case of It is very much like taking the lift and going to the 60th floor, and well, after you've gone to the 60th floor, you can only come down again when you want to do your shopping. The Duke of York, he had 10,000 men, you know, all that business. It becomes only that. But it isn't that. That is in the dualistic realm, in the realm of seesaw. Not that equilibration, but this poise by which you are in complete and permanent oneness with the totality takes place with the transmutation of the psychical nature. This transmutation of the psyche means that the soul has become completely healthy, just like a physical body can be completely healthy. I see, this is something of what lies before the individual who is truly serious and religious minded. We must see very clearly there is nothing for me in it. It happens. And this is the great thing. The particular me has become transformed into a pure vessel of gold to contain the nectar of immortality, to let the divine life be contained in it and overflow, because it can't contain. I mean, any similes I give, any language I use is nonsense besides the reality. You can sense that reality yourselves. But this is religion, if you like, deals with transcendence. Through the years, I've always said, the context of religion is the context of transcendence. But that comes to flower in the individual living being only in so far as he understands these teachings. With regard to the senses, with regard to objects, with regard to pleasure above all. Because it's this pleasure drive that bedevils the whole situation. Watch the pleasure drive. Don't fight against it, don't indulge it. This is the problem. This is the thing which is so arduous that, to use a commoner garden phrase, most people fall by the wayside, as we call it. You see? Have you noticed? One goes to an uplift meeting. One is sort of lifted up like that, exalted, in a sublime state. And when one comes out of the place, one goes to such and such a restaurant and gorges till they get indigestion next day. That's all. Now watch it. This is how we actually act, isn't it? When we are exalted, when we are lifted up, we must remain at the bottom of the valley, lowly and humble. True humility. Then you can't fall below that. And if I remain at the bottom of the valley, in my most exalted states, then indeed, eternal God is present here, and I know it. Then I am harmless and can do no wrong and no evil. There is nothing which weighs on my conscience, nothing which raises an inner conflict then, and so forth. But this is true yoga, yuj. the rejoining. The restoration into complete harmony with the whole. And I have told you all this today because I want to suggest something which, if you care to, if you really care to, you can try. It, all this sort of hinged around the question of words, objects, mortality, and the release into immortality. Not that objects and words will disappear, they'll all be there. But you will be the immortal in the midst of objects and words. You will be the immortal embodied in mortal form. See? All right. So now, words. How many words, unnecessary words, go out of me during the 24 hours of the day? There are certain words which have to be used. You're in the office and the boss comes in and asks a question, of course you have to answer it. Answer him in 10 words if possible. Better still in 5. Best of all in 1. Yes or no. It's quite enough. Don't launch into vast speeches. Quite unnecessary. If you want to ask for something from anybody, please may I have a pencil, or whatever it is that is needed. That's all. Don't say why you want it and your pencil fell off and you've lost it and you can't find it and you've got to do all this, you see, because the so-and-so said that I must have this, that and the other done by... We're absolutely mad. But this is precisely what we do. One word, if possible. If unfortunately necessary, use 2 words. And beyond that is the state of misery with words. You see? Now, just watch during the coming fortnight if we can be free of this vomiting out of torrents of words. That is purely on the physical plane, with the body, the audible speech. Watch also the torrent of words that goes through the brain night and day. In response to the stimuli of objects, sense perceptions, desire for sense indulgence and all the rest of it. All the fantasies centering around one's ego, one's vanity. Egoism and vanity are 2 of the most powerful forces that maintain the greater part of the business world. I've had this from a very dear friend of mine who's chairman of one of the big stores in this country. He's an old friend of mine and we often meet and have a few philosophical exchanges, and I asked him, look, from your own experience, if people were free of egoism and vanity, how much of the business world would come to an end? He spent, quite 3 or 4 minutes thinking. And then he said, well, it might be something like 95%. 95% of the buying and selling of the business world would come to an end if egoism and vanity were out. Now consider how much our silent talk is in terms of egoism, vanity. passion, malevolence, ill will. Think carefully. If you really are sensitive, compassion will come out of you. So practice during the fortnight. No longer pushing the stream of words. Shall I read this little quotation? What the Buddha says about idle talk. I've read it once before, or twice before. In fact, he calls it low conversation. Talk about kings, robbers, ministers of state, war, terrors, battles, foods, drinks, clothes, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives and relationships, equipages, villages, towns, cities, countries, tales about women, and we are in modern times ought to add, and men, and heroes. Gossip at street corners or wells, ghost stories, desultory talk, speculations about the land and sea, and we should add in modern times the stock exchange, about becoming and not becoming thus or thus. This is just a little summary I've made of all he says. With regard to speech, he says, putting away lying words, slander, harshness of speech. Then he goes on, whatsoever word is blameless, pleasant to the ear, lovely, reaching to the heart, urbane, curious thing to say, pleasing to the people, agreeable to the people, such are the words he speaks. He's talking of himself. You see, the Buddha is talking of himself. This is what he says. And if you want a really positive statement out of the Upanishads, and I'll stop after this, mustn't overtax your patience, comes in the Varaha Upanishad. Always practice silence. And that silence is represented in the awareness that oneself is the ultimate reality, Parabrahman. Two or three sentences later, again, practice silence. And in the very next sentence again, always practice silence. You see? The importance of this silence. Because that silence is the peace of eternal life, not of death. That is that silence. And we have the symbol of it in terms of our cosmos. Between the galaxies, there is perfect silence. The silence which lies in the solitude between the eternal stars.
It's also like your tie, Piros. It's also like your tie. Golden.
Oh! Yes. Oh.